Welcome to WORT's local news for Wednesday, April 24th, 2024. I'm your host, Vicki Iden.
And I'm your host, Robert McClure. In tonight's news, elected officials and community leaders in Dane County issued a statement today calling for a Madison Alder's resignation.
A recent analysis found that women serving in state legislatures are nearly four times as likely as men to experience abuse of a sexual nature.
State lawmakers are cutting higher education funding across the country, but who is paying the price?
And in the second half, more insight from the former curator at Momoka, some headlines from 57 years ago, and the most comprehensive weather report on the airwaves.
So stay tuned, but first we'll go live to London for news from around the world from the BBC.
Hello, I'm Roisin Hasty with the BBC News. Police have clashed with pro-Palestinian student protesters in Texas and California as a wave of unrest intensifies at university campuses across the United States. During a visit to Columbia University in New York, the Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives, Mike Johnson, said the protests must end. He was greeted with booing and heckling as he complained that radicals and extremists had been allowed to intimidate Jewish students. Our correspondent Emma Vardy is at the University of Southern California in Los Angeles.
Pro-Palestinian activists here feel that free speech is being shut down, but then you have Jewish students here saying they actually feel threatened on campus. So it's an extremely difficult balance to strike. Students I've been speaking to here say the protest has grown in numbers and support has been galvanized really by what's been happening elsewhere in the United States. The arrests that happened in Columbia, in Texas, have helped to, I suppose, attract more people to these protests and helped it to gather momentum.
The Prime Minister of Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu, has strongly criticised the protests on US college campuses. Mr. Netanyahu described the response of several US university presidents as shameful.
What's happening on America's college campuses is horrific. Anti-Semitic mobs have taken over leading universities. They call for the annihilation of Israel. They attack Jewish students. They attack Jewish faculty. This is reminiscent of what happened in German universities in the 1930s. It's unconscionable. It has to be stopped. It has to be condemned and condemned unequivocally.
Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky has said the new $61 billion military assistance package from the United States would help continue to protect lives against Russian attacks. Earlier, President Biden said that the U.S. would begin sending weapons and equipment to Ukraine right away after he signed a long-awaited bill a day after it was passed by Congress. Our security correspondent Frank Gardner has more.
It will make a difference, but it's not going to win Ukraine the war. And I think it's important to have a bit of reality check. It's a massive relief to Ukraine because without this so-called supplementary aid package, Ukraine was quite possibly going to lose this war this year. They lack something that Russia has got, mass. And what this aid package will do is replenish those Ukrainian stocks in air defense missiles. Russia has been absolutely pummeling Ukraine with a combination of drones and missiles.
The United States has called on all military forces in Sudan to immediately cease attacks in Al-Fashur, the last city in the Darfur region, still under army control. UN officials have warned of a catastrophe if the army and rival paramilitary rapid support forces fight for control of the city. It's home to around 500,000 people who've been displaced. World News from the BBC. A Venezuelan diplomat who has been picked by opposition parties to challenge President Nicolas Maduro in July's elections has called for a peaceful democratic transition. Edmundo Gonzalez said he was committed to freeing political prisoners and allowing exiled Venezuelans to return home. He said action needed to be taken on poverty, inflation, health and education. The Spanish Prime Minister, Pedro Sanchez, says he's stepping back from public duties while he considers whether to resign over corruption allegations against his wife. Mr. Sanchez complained that his political opponents had made scandalous and false allegations. Guy Hedgeco reports from Madrid.
The news that Begoña Gómez was under investigation over allegations of influence peddling came as a shock. Some news outlets have been reporting that she used her position to influence the awarding of a COVID rescue package. They also reported that she lobbied on behalf of a consortium which won lucrative government contracts. The plaintiff in this case is a labour union which has been closely linked to the far right. In a letter he posted on social media, the Prime Minister said he was clearing his diary for the next few days to consider his future, and that he will make an announcement on it next Monday.
TikTok has vowed to fight a new law which could see it sold or banned in the United States. The firm's boss, Shouzi Chu, said the US Constitution was on its side. The legislation gives TikTok 9 months to divest from its Chinese parent company ByteDance or be blocked in the US. The World Health Organization says global immunization efforts have saved at least 154 million lives in the last 50 years. In a report published by The Lancet, the organization said vaccination had been the biggest single contributor to the prevention of deadly infections since the 1970s. The organization said the measles vaccine had saved the most lives. BBC News.
Good evening, this is Rob McClure and Vicki Iden bringing you your local news, coming to you live from the WORT studios on Bedford Street in downtown Madison. Here are this evening's headlines.
The U.S. Senate passed a far-ranging foreign aid package yesterday, with President Biden signing it into law today. The legislation sends $95 billion in aid to Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan. About $60 billion of the aid goes to assist Ukraine in its war with Russia. Israel will receive $26 billion to support their conflict with Hamas, and around $9 billion is intended for Taiwan and the Indo-Pacific. Wisconsin senators were divided, with Republican Ron Johnson voting no and Democrat Tammy Baldwin voting yes, though Baldwin has recently called for a ceasefire between Israel and Hamas. Baldwin also called for President Biden to push for a recognized, non-militarized Palestinian state, reports the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Meanwhile, Senator Johnson has been critical of sending Ukraine more aid for their ongoing war in the past, and has also complained that the recent foreign aid bill fails to address the U.S.-Mexico border. Last week, Wisconsin's U.S. Representative Mark Pocan, a Democrat, voted no on the bill, citing concerns about the growing civilian death toll in Gaza. The bill also includes language that could lead to a ban on the social media app TikTok. CNN noted that the Biden administration will continue to use TikTok to engage voters, despite the president signing the bill into law.
Governor Tony Evers announced yesterday that Wisconsin is receiving a federal grant of $62 million to provide solar power for lower and middle income households in the state. Wisconsin is one of 60 states, territories, tribal governments, municipalities, and nonprofit agencies across the country to receive funding from the Environmental Protection Agency via their Solar for All program. The aim of the $7 billion federal program is to broaden access to solar power to more than 900,000 households that would not normally be able to afford it. The announcement comes the day after Earth Day, which began in Wisconsin over 50 years ago. In their bid to win Wisconsin's portion of the grant, the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation said that more solar power would help the state prevent nearly 2 million tons of carbon dioxide emissions entering the atmosphere each year.
Betsy Morgan, interim chancellor at UW-La Crosse, is moving to have former chancellor Joe Gao removed from his 10-year faculty position at the university. Back in December, Gao was fired as chancellor by the school's governing board over pornographic videos Gao and his wife had made and posted online. Gao served as chancellor from 2007 to 2023 and had planned to retire in spring of 2024. Current Chancellor Morgan levied three charges of unethical conduct against Gao on April 16th for posting the videos with his wife online, for not cooperating with the related investigation launched by the university, and for using university equipment to make and distribute the videos. Gowan contends that the adult content he created was not made using university devices or with any state funds, reports the Wisconsin State Journal. The university hearing committee has 20 days to schedule a hearing on Gao's dismissal. Gao has chosen that the hearing be public.
A few months after announcing that the school would close this year, Universities of Wisconsin officials have announced that UW-Platteville will vacate the Richland campus on July 1st. The surprising announcement comes after months of ongoing negotiations to determine what to do with the campus buildings. Jeff Bourant, the vice president of university relations for the UW system, sent a letter on Tuesday stating that the university had no other viable option but to abandon the campus entirely. Richland County officials expressed alarm over a, quote, potential economic crisis, unquote, although a recent law passed by Governor Evers could provide up to $2 million for a community impacted by a UW branch closing. Bourant also said that the UW system would cover the costs of utilities and provide custodial maintenance for the campus buildings through the end of June. We'll have more on higher education funding woes later in the show.
A technical glitch in the UW Memorial Union's daily event calendar is getting the blame for an interruption in voting hours at the polling place during this month's spring election, reports the Capital Times. As a result, at about 2:30 p.m. on April 2nd, student employees at the union removed some signs identifying a polling area and erroneously told a small number of people that they could not vote there, according to a university spokesperson. The signs were replaced at about 4:15, and student staff were correctly informed that voting was indeed going on, Tyrell said. Voting hours were extended at the union by court order to correct the oversight, and the university advised students by text and social media that they had an extra 90 minutes to vote.
The co-owner of an Eastside nightclub plans to convert the landmark Madison Gospel Tabernacle building at 1925 Winnebago Street into an entertainment venue, the Wisconsin State Journal reports. Toffer Christensen, head of Christensen Company and co-owner of the Baroque, says the renamed Atwood Music Hall could be staging live music by early 2025. The company has secured more than $2 million in loans from private and public sources. The project is under city review and could get the green light in June. And those were the headlines for this evening. Now on to the rest of the day's top stories.
Today, a coalition of 25 elected officials and community leaders in Dane County issued a joint statement calling for a Madison Alder's resignation following recent accusations of domestic abuse. WORT news producer Faye Parks has the story.
Current and former Dane County supervisors, state representatives, and leaders in crisis intervention signed onto the statement released earlier this afternoon. The statement stands in solidarity with survivors of intimate partner violence and calls on Madison Alder Charles Miadze to resign from public office. That's after, late last month, some of his former partners accused him of domestic abuse. Supervisor Brenda Yang, who represents Sun Prairie on the Dane County Board, wrote the joint statement. She says that one of Miadze's accusers had actually confided in her years ago.
I wanted to help her, but I know that it takes a while for somebody to be comfortable enough to want to share their story. And so I didn't push or press her, but I offered my support and that when she is ready to come out, that I would be more than happy to help and bring this to light.
Alder Miadze, who represents Madison's North Side, has denied the allegations. He's been arrested in the past on charges of abuse, but has never been convicted, reports the Capital Times. Shannon Berry, the executive director of DAYS, signed today's joint statement. She says that allegations against public figures can have a far-reaching impact, especially when there are no consequences.
It really reinforces for survivors that if they reach out or if they share their story, that they won't be believed.
Meanwhile, Miadze's colleagues on the Common Council have largely sided with his accusers. In last week's meeting, Alders unanimously passed a resolution affirming support for survivors of domestic violence and abuse. The council was not allowed to make direct references to Alder Miadze, though some Alders spoke vaguely of attempting to remove him from office in a formal process. Dana Pelabon, executive director at the RCC Sexual Violence Resource Center, also signed today's statement, saying that a formal hearing in the Common Council would ultimately put undue pressure on Alder Miadze's accusers.
To me, and this is just my personal feeling, a resignation goes a long way to show people that this person is listening and is open to the idea of what restorative justice looks like. One of the main tenets is acknowledgement of harm, listening to what it is that the person who was harmed wants, and moving forward in those manners. The people who have come forward have been very, very clear that what they are asking is for Alderman Dazzi to step down.
And Shannon Berry added today that Days often gets more requests for support when there are high-profile situations in the media.
So we just want to really reiterate to people that Days is always available. All of our services are free and confidential, and those services can be accessed through our 24-hour helpline, which is 608-251-4445.
Reporting for WORT News, I'm Faye Parks.
The 2024 election is inching closer, with concerns still being raised about a hostile political climate. Organizations that support women candidates say there are gender gaps when it comes to politicians being on the receiving ends of threats and harassment. Wisconsin News Connection's Mike Moen has more.
Wisconsin women have made progress in closing gaps when it comes to being elected to public office. But some voices worry the movement might slow down as candidates see increasing levels of threats and harassment. The Brennan Center for Justice recently issued findings that detail the threatening behavior those in the political arena are experiencing now. Women were 3 to 4 times as likely as men to experience abuse targeting their gender. Erin Villardi of the Advocacy and Assistance Group, Vote Run Lead, says this creates more unfairness in areas such as resource planning for a campaign.
We see women candidates and incumbents right now having to pay for security, right? Having to put in their budgets, in their campaign funds, in their line items, you know, for their campaigns, a security detail.
Ann Villardi says because of the worsening climate, the threats are extending to almost all other candidates, including conservative white men. She and other researchers call on party leaders to strongly condemn political violence. They also recommend that each state implement stronger protection for office holders. And Villardi says it's not just women candidates and incumbents having to deal with this behavior. Women working as top aides and political journalists are subject to more hateful rhetoric these days.
This is something that permeates women in politics, not just for the folks that are stepping up to lead, but for the ecosystem of women around them.
And if more women decide not to run or seek re-election as a result, Villardi says this means there will be fewer opportunities for gender equality in leadership positions in state legislatures and Congress. She urges constituents to send messages of support to women office holders as they weigh these challenges and their political futures. This is Mike Moen for Wisconsin News Connection. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org. Support for this reporting was provided by the Carnegie Corporation of New York.
It's Volunteer Appreciation Week, and organizations around the country are celebrating their volunteers, including WORT. The Staff Collective wanted to pop on the air to express our sincere thanks to all our WORT volunteers, past and present.
Every day, WORT volunteers go above and beyond.
Whether running the soundboards,
interviewing state representatives,
organizing the record library,
curating music playlists,
answering phones,
or making coffee.
For every hour you hear on the air, whether a music program, news show, or talk show, the hosts, reporters, and producers have worked countless hours off air to make that show as informative and entertaining as possible. They spend hours searching for music, reading books to review, researching local elections, and finding the events and guests you didn't know you were missing.
If you've ever visited the WORT booth or attended a WORT event, contacted the station for any reason, purchased raffle tickets to support our cause, or even just checked our website calendars for updates, you've directly experienced the positive impact of our dedicated and friendly volunteers.
Thanks to the unwavering efforts and selfless generosity of our volunteers, WORT has been a constant voice on the airwaves for an impressive 48 plus years. Their time, talents, and contributions are a true reflection of our vibrant community.
Thank you, WORT volunteers, for everything you have done and continue to do.
Happy Volunteer Appreciation Week!
WORT thanks its listener sponsors and Five Nines, a locally owned cloud service provider of enterprise-level IT infrastructure consulting, hosting, and management services. On the web at fivenines.com. Phone number 512-1000.
The time is now 6:19 p.m. and you're listening to the live local volunteer-produced news on WORT.
Across the country, state lawmakers are cutting funding to their most prominent public universities. That dwindling support for higher education was the subject of a panel at UW-Madison earlier this evening, and the School of Education's Dr. Taylor Odell was one of the panelists. He told our news producer, Faye Parks, that these funding cuts are often politically motivated and have far-reaching consequences.
Thank you for joining me, Dr. Odell.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So you're taking part in a panel on higher education funding this afternoon. Can you give us the rundown on who will be there and what your main focus will be?
Today's panel is focused on the future of flagship universities. And if folks are unfamiliar, flagship university is traditionally defined as the state's top public institution of higher education. So kind of the most premier institution in Wisconsin, that's the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And so what we're talking about with reporters, journalists, academics, and policymakers is the kind of suite of issues that are facing flagship universities right now, from political issues to funding issues and challenges to changing student demographics, and thinking about where flagships move forward to best meet the needs of the state, of the students, and of higher education generally.
So, of course, the UW system's funding has been in the news a lot recently, especially after the deal with the state legislature that cut DEI efforts in order to free up money from the state. Would you see this move as a sudden change or something that you've noticed over time, a sort of trend that's been happening here?
So I think an issue that's affecting many institutions, but especially flagship generally, is the fact that state funding for higher education is not what it used to be. So in Wisconsin, the state of Wisconsin used to fund about 40% of the University of Wisconsin-Madison's total budget. Today, that's now less than 15%. And so as institutions, we have rising costs. The price of doing business, just like your grocery bills, your rent bills, and things like that go up. Well, the bills to keep the lights on to operate at UW-Madison also go up. And so if one of our big streams of revenue is state appropriations and that's going down, then the institution has to find a way to support student success, to increase scholarships, et cetera, from other sources. So that can come from tuition and fees, it can come from private dollars, it can come from the federal government, et cetera, et cetera. But what's problematic is the fact that institutional funding for the University of Wisconsin has been going down over time. And now what funding is on the table is highly politicized or tied to deals like the one that existed around DEI. When in reality, state funding for higher education is nowhere near where it used to be and nowhere near where it should be to ultimately serve students and families in the state. I think this is definitely a national trend that we've seen. However, what's traditional is that the institution and the state work together to come up with a funding kind of priority or a funding plan that supports both needs of the institution and the state, rather than strong-arming institutions into accepting what small funds are available, kind of in line with a political will.
So I saw that on today's panel, there will be a speaker from the University of Minnesota. And so I'm curious, you mentioned that this is a nationwide issue. Are they facing similar problems? How are they faring? And then how do we stack up against other states?
Yeah, so one of my co-panelists is a faculty member at the University of Minnesota, and he does research on flagships generally and how they have been responsive to these changes in state funding cuts or state budget priorities, et cetera, et cetera. And so I think that he'll discuss his understanding of how these trends look nationally. But I will say Wisconsin isn't unique in this regard. This is occurring across the U.S. However, what is unique in Wisconsin is the level of funding. So I kind of mentioned previously, you know, the state used to pay for 40% of UW's budget. It's now down to 15%. That occurred similarly in other states, but those other states have been recovering since then, year over year. So the 15%, if you will, is growing back to 20%, back to 25%, et cetera, where the state is taking a more vested interest in state universities. That has not happened in Wisconsin. That number is still going down. We have some of the lowest state spending per college student in the country, and we have some of the lowest financial aid per college student in the country. So Wisconsin is unique in that regard, in that it went down like everybody else, our state funding did, but that state funding is not creeping up like our peers are.
Would you say this issue is largely political, or is it also just generally a lack of enough money on the state level?
It's definitely not a lack of enough money. The state of Wisconsin, like many states, has an unprecedented budget surplus. And so it's definitely the choice of policymakers of how they want to spend that money. And over time, they've chosen to spend less of the money they have available on higher education. And so this year, what was on the table was not how much more money is the University of Wisconsin going to get, but how much less money is it going to get, or how much money are we actually going to take away? Matters that have actually really little to do with the operation of institutions or the funding to institutions, like things around DEI, have become intertwined with funding. So, for example, when UW would traditionally receive funds from the state, those funds would be used for operations, keeping the lights on, capital facilities, building a new engineering building, giving scholarships to high-achieving students in the state. The conversation wasn't about how can we support those services. It's how can we reduce other things that you're doing so that you can receive these funds or receive less of a cut.
Are there other options on the table for UW-Madison if the funding continues to go down?
There are two major revenue sources that institutions operate on. One is tuition fees, so what students and families pay, and one is the state. So, right, we're a public institution of higher education. We are the University of Wisconsin, but the state of Wisconsin is only paying for 15% of the budget, and that's meant that students and families have to pay more of the budget. That's a decision that's been made by policymakers to get down to 15% and to shoulder the other costs on students and families. A problem, however, in the state of Wisconsin has been that for the last 10 or so years, we've been under a tuition freeze. So that means that these institutions couldn't raise tuition fee rates to garner more funding from students and families. So the two primary ways that institutions make money, getting support from the state and getting tuition and fees from students and families, those were both held flat or, like for state appropriations, actually declined. So that's ultimately why there are so many stories that you've seen around funding issues, structural budget deficits at many of the universities of Wisconsin campuses, because they've kind of been strangled from a funding perspective. And so that's why many campuses are closing. That's why many programs are closing. The University of Wisconsin-Madison is in a slightly different position. As a flagship, which is what we'll discuss today at the forum, we have other mechanisms of raising funds, like getting grants from the federal government, like engaging in private philanthropy, and like raising funds through what we call auxiliaries, like athletics, residence halls, and things like that. So the effect hasn't been felt as sharply at UW-Madison as it has been on regional comprehensives, right? We're not talking about closing UW-Madison like we're talking about closing other satellite campuses, but that doesn't mean that this concern is not continuing to develop and continuing to snowball. If the state continues to invest less and less in the University of Wisconsin-Madison, which is a top public institution in the country, then the ability of UW-Madison to really fulfill its mission of research, of community engagement, of serving the Wisconsin idea, of creating more teachers, of creating more engineers in the state, is going to be diminished because there's going to be less services for supporting students. There's going to be less services or scholarships available. There's going to be less things for outreach and engagement and extension. And so it's very much, I think, in the state's hand right now of how well do they want the University of Wisconsin to be able to serve their constituents and the state at large.
So before I let you go, is there anything else you'd like to share?
I think that it's really great that this conversation is happening. I think that Wisconsin has a really strong potential of partnering with state legislators and institutional leaders to identify and see how the universities of Wisconsin are really serving the needs of Wisconsin across the state and what types of state funding and scholarships for students would it really take to really propel that forward and to make sure that we aren't facing a teacher shortage, that we have all of the nurses that we need, that we have all the facilities that are required, and that we have all of the scholarships that we want to make sure that every student in Wisconsin has a chance at having this world-class education that we're providing at UW-Madison. But it's going to really take partnership and collaboration between policymakers and between institutional leaders to make that happen. And that's what we're going to try and get to today on this panel on flagships.
Thank you again for agreeing to speak with me, Dr. Odell.
Yeah, thanks so much for the invitation.
That was Dr. Taylor Odell, an assistant professor of educational policy studies at UW-Madison.
And you're listening to Handcrafted Local News here on WORT. Stay with us for the second half of the show. A lot more coming at you. We'll hear more from the former curator at the Madison Museum of Contemporary Art. We'll travel back in time as we do each Wednesday. Today, back to 1967. And we've got rain coming up this weekend. I'll give you all the possible details you would want to hear on the complete forecast.
But first, we'll take a quick break and then check in on some world headlines. Back in a flash.
With the BBC News, I'm Roisin Hasty. Police have clashed with pro-Palestinian student protesters in Texas and California as a wave of unrest intensifies at university campuses across the United States. The Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives, Mike Johnson, visited Columbia University in New York and called for an end to the protests. In recorded remarks, the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu condemned those taking part in the protests as anti-Semitic mobs. Mr. Netanyahu criticized the response of several U.S. university presidents as shameful. President Volodymyr Zelensky of Ukraine has again thanked the United States for the new $61 billion military aid package. Washington has confirmed that it sent long-range missiles to Ukraine for use inside its territory. The United States has urged all military forces in Sudan to immediately stop attacks in Al-Fashur, the last city in the Darfur region, still under army control. It's home to about 500,000 people who've been displaced by more than a year of fighting in Sudan. The Prime Minister of Spain, Pedro Sanchez, has announced that he's considering whether to resign over corruption allegations against his wife. He said he's stepping back from official duties in the meantime. The right-wing challenger in North Macedonia's presidential poll has won the first round by a large majority. She received nearly 40% of the vote. The World Health Organization says global immunization efforts have saved at least 154 million lives in the last 50 years. In a report, the organization said vaccination had been the biggest single contributor to the prevention of deadly infections since the 1970s. At least 10 people have died as a result of heavy flooding in the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. The Kenya Meteorological Department has warned that more heavy rains are expected in the coming days. BBC News.
The time is now 6:32, and you're listening to the live local news on WORT. I'm your host, Robert McClure, here with my co-host, Vicki Iden. Thanks for staying with us.
This week, Framing Culture presents part two of the interview with Leah Kolb, the former curator of exhibitions at MMOCA. That's the Madison Museum of Contemporary Art. In the last episode, Leah told feature contributor José Teixeira about her career and the projects accomplished at the museum. Today, Leah explores more in depth her curatorial work at Second Story in Lexington, Kentucky, while also reflecting on the broader art world.
Framing Culture. Hello, and welcome to Framing Culture. This is part two of the interview with Leah Kolb. She's an art curator and worked for more than a decade at MMOCA, but is now based in Lexington, Kentucky, where she is the director of Second Story, a new experimental art space and gallery. Today, Leah will share more about this project, and we will discuss general questions around the art world.
I think what I find really interesting here in Lexington and what I've been able to do here, which has been incredibly rewarding, is just starting something. yes, there's like money and energy and time involved, but there's also grant funding you can get. If not from the state, you can get it, you know, from national organizations. You also, you know, start building up a network of people who believe in what you're doing and who believe that what you're doing is very important and vital to the cultural health of the community, who want to be able to support and donate.
And thank you so much, Leah, for bringing Lexington now to our conversation and also your project called Second Story. Tell me a little bit more about that project of yours and how you see it, as you were explaining now, as a project, a self-made project that is enriching and giving a necessary new fresh air, new movement within Lexington. I believe Lexington is probably smaller than Madison in terms of area and population.
They say it's about the same size. Lexington is similar to Madison in the sense that it's a university town. And so there's a lot, I think, of energy and interest in culture, which I think opens up these opportunities, right, for smaller organizations to pop up.
Are you happy with the fact that you have now total freedom and control over a project?
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. Of course, when you're with an institution, there's so much support built in and so much support that I feel like I didn't even necessarily realize, because like that I was lucky enough to sort of walk into it. But it's, you know, doing it on your own. Yes, there's the benefit that you can kind of do what you want. My limitations are space and money, right? Yeah. And time, I guess. But I think, you know, with Second Story, the mission is really to create the space of not only artistic freedom, but curatorial freedom and intellectual freedom. And so not only working with artists who I believe are doing really terrific, important work, but then what's been as fun is then programming talks around the shows, right? And so not always necessarily an art talk. Certainly we have those, but bringing in, for example, I worked with John Hitchcock for the opening exhibition. So those of you who don't know, Lexington has named itself the horse capital of the world. So there's a lot of horse racing and horse breeding here. John had started working on this body of work where he was making, he's part Comanche, part Kiowa, part Northern European, but he was really exploring the Comanche-Kiowa relationship to horses, because the Comanches in particular were the horse warriors of the plains prior to being forced onto the reservation. And so this relationship between indigenous people in the plains and horses, it's a huge thing. So he made this gorgeous body of work that explored indigenous relationships to the horse. And so, I mean, it was wonderful and an honor to be able to work with him on this show, particularly in Lexington, to show Lexington a different type of horse culture. But then also we had such amazing programming. I brought in an indigenous archaeologist who came and gave a talk. He had published this major study in Science Mag, and the journal Science, a research project that reoriented the entire timeline of when horses were integrated into indigenous life and culture. And so he came and gave a talk. I was able to partner with the University of Kentucky's anthropology department.
I have to say that I love the fact that you are not only interested in the visual arts world and lexicon, but also trying to expand with those talks and conversations and debates into the social sciences or the hard sciences. But it's very interesting that it becomes a more multidisciplinary space and not necessarily a narrow art space, so to speak.
And I think that's one of the things that I'm really interested in, is figuring out, I mean, I think we're in an interesting place societally speaking right now, where it's hard to talk about things from, I guess, from either side, if you want to say it, you know. And I want Second Story, because I think art and artists, they open up this space to be able to dig into some of the messy stuff, right? And to be able to talk about it. And I want to not be able to shy away from some of the more complicated things and not sort of be canceled or not be criticized for digging up some of the more complex topics. And also looking at them from various perspectives. And can we look at it from, and I think that helps also bring in people who aren't necessarily contemporary art people, right? It helps them be able to approach contemporary art. And I think it helps people who are interested in contemporary art be able to think about these major topics and subjects that artists are addressing in their work, but from a broader perspective.
Initially, I was not going to expand for so long the conversation between us, but you are touching on an issue that as an artist, as a cultural producer myself, and connected for so many years with both academic but also professional institutions within the arts, and I'm aware of many individuals and teams and networks of people who actually try to consciously challenge these and open the avenues of conversation in a way that all of this cultural conversation becomes increasingly more interdisciplinary and open to life. So I want to ask you this, how do you see personally and professionally the fact that more times than not, the art world tends to fall into this default mechanism of being very much concerned and narcissistically looking into itself instead of trying to reach out and trying to open the avenues for the conversation and, quite honestly, breaking these taboos or these myths around high culture and low culture? How do you see all of this?
I think that what I've been seeing a lot, especially within the last couple of years, is that museums in particular are really scared to do or say the wrong thing because it's really easy to do and say the wrong thing. And I think that there's this massive backlash that happens when there's a misstep or when there's a perceived misstep. I think that it makes it really hard to have any real substantive conversations outside of like the actual art itself. But the thing about contemporary art is it oftentimes isn't just about the art. It's about all of the societal things that are informing the art. And so even if it's not on an institutional level per se, but I think it's really important for communities to have a space to be able to address or at least explore, think about those things. And so what I say about Second Story is our mission is to prioritize creative risk-taking and collaboration, also critical thinking. And I think the critical thinking aspect for me is really a main priority, not only with the artists that I work with, but with the programming that we present. And I think just really with the type of atmosphere that I'm really hoping to create here in Lexington with Second Story. And I agree with you. I think that there can be a little bit of an inward gazing thing that happens oftentimes. And I think that the way that you're actually going to pull the most meaning out of art is to be able to have a broader view and to bring all of the pieces together and also expand it outwards, right?
Regardless of the fact that we might appreciate more or less the work of artist A, B, or C, the fact that art takes the risk to become this space of conversation, because I'm a bit concerned about certain kind of dark forces at play in the world when it comes to censorship, in situations in which censorship, for example, in the art world, in which theoretically we are so free, and all of a sudden you realize there is a danger that the arts become this space that has been hijacked.
I think you're really right. I think that there's something that I've seen happening where, again, I think it has to do with, I don't know if it's like a discomfort with risk taking, and because you're going to get criticized now from both sides of the equation, right? It's certain factions who are like, well, I don't want my child being exposed to that. Then you've got other factions who are like, well, who has a right to tell certain stories or to represent certain things? And I think it gets really hard then, not only for artists, but for institutions or for organizations to be able to know how to do it responsibly. And I think doing it responsibly is important, but I think doing it, right? The point is to do it.
This derives from a very polarized society, not only politically, but I think the politics infiltrate the personal and also infiltrates, obviously, something that we might call the art world. And so this fear of the debate, this fear of the confrontation, it's something that we got accustomed that art would always bring, especially the avant-garde movements throughout art history. And all of a sudden, it's like, what's going on here that's not necessarily happening, or people are not willing to take that path.
I think that leads to like this sort of sanitized version of everything where you're like ostensibly dealing with, you know, kind of heavy topics, but in this very sort of, I guess, non-controversial or agreeable way. To me, that's not as interesting.
Absolutely. And Leah, we are at the end of our conversation. Thank you so much for chatting with me and going deeper into some of these topics. And I wish you the best.
Thank you. It was a joy to see you, Jose. Thank you for the opportunity.
And it's time now for the most comprehensive weather report on the airwaves with WORT weather guru, Rob McClure.
Well, the showers and thunderstorms we were expecting over the past couple of days never did materialize. Either Monday evening with the warm front that passed at that time, or yesterday afternoon's cold frontal showers that we were expecting. In both those instances, you could almost see the atmosphere struggling to overcome the dry air that was sitting between the cloud deck and ground level. A few sprinkles did actually reach the ground Monday evening, but not enough even to register a measurement out at the recording station at the airport. And there was some nice vertical build to the cumulus that developed yesterday afternoon as the passing cold front at that time cooled the air just above ground level and steepened the low-level lapse rates. So precipitation did look promising for a while, but the few thunderstorms that did manage to get going up in Wood and Juneau counties died out well before they reached us down here in the evening. Dry air is not going to be an issue with our next round of convection, which will start Friday morning and last, the way it's appearing currently, right on through the coming weekend. There will be some breaks in there. They'll inevitably have some low predictability in terms of timing, I'm afraid, just given the relatively localized nature of thunderstorm development. But have a look at the water vapor image of the contiguous United States that we have linked up on the right up at the top of the WORT weather webpage this evening, and you'll be able to see why this incoming round of showers and thunderstorms will have a very different and more summer-like tenor to it than this last one did. Of note on the image, if you do happen to pull it up, are the yellow isobars, which will show you the surface pressure fields and thus allow you to see where the surface high-pressure cells are located. Those piles of dry, subsident air are important for a lot of reasons, but one of them is that they generally occupy the lowest couple of miles of the atmosphere, which is also where a lot of the atmospheric moisture moves around. So high-pressure systems can and do occasionally get in the way of that, as did the one which you can see on the image over the past few days blocking us off from the Gulf of Mexico as it moves from Kansas down across the Western Gulf and over towards the Carolinas. That delayed the moisture returning northward enough to keep the precipitation that might have been seen here over the past couple of days down to our south and southeast. The current surface high that's been keeping our skies so clear, though, is centered over southeastern Ontario and the central Great Lakes. So as the next low-pressure system travels up this way and backs our winds southeasterly and south tomorrow, there's going to be no inhibition at all to Gulf moisture streaming back northward up the eastern plains of Mississippi Valley. Incidentally, if you're looking at the water vapor image, you can see the upper low that'll be producing our weekend precipitation now heading ashore over northern Baja California. The upper trough of which that circulation is a part is going to be slow moving and therefore likely to eject a couple different surface circulations at us from the southwest. The first lifting up through western Iowa and into Minnesota Friday night into Saturday. And a second one then on a fairly similar track the way it's looking later Saturday into Sunday. Once the warm front with that first circulation passes north of us, that'll be Friday night. We'll remain in what'll be quite mild, damp air through the rest of the weekend. Very summer-like, actually, with plenty of low-level moisture available for lifting into additional thunderstorms. We'll probably experience a break in the precipitation through parts of Saturday anyway as a large-scale lift subsides between the two passing lows. But showers will likely still be a sort of intermittent hazard that day before more organized convection then moves back in Saturday night into Sunday with the second low. So expect a good couple or 3 inches of rain coming down, I think, before we clear out more substantially on Monday. Back to tonight, though. Clear skies will see increasing high clouds later in the night. Those won't thicken up much, but they may hold us off freezing, or at least any extensive freezing as we get on towards dawn. But otherwise, the temperatures will bottom out probably around 30 degrees by dawn, at least for a couple hours, with light southeasterly winds down generally below about 5 or 7 miles per hour. Tomorrow, mostly sunny skies should allow the temperatures, I think, to hit 60 on the southeasterly winds, which will come up to about 8 to 12 miles per hour by late afternoon or evening. High clouds will become more prevalent through the day, especially later in the day, then deepen downward as we go overnight, with temperatures dropping into the low 40s on southeasterly winds at 10 to 15 miles per hour. And showers and thunderstorms will then work into the area, perhaps somewhat abruptly, from the southwest in the early to mid-morning hours of Friday. Perhaps not reaching the eastern parts of the listening area to, say, 10 or 11 or perhaps even noon. Cells will be fairly fast moving from generally southwest to northeast, but are likely to continue off and on through much of the rest of Friday. Temperatures will climb slowly through the 40s up into the low and mid-50s on what will be stiffening southeasterly winds that day, increasing to about 12 to 20 miles per hour by evening and becoming somewhat gusty. A more concerted round of convection may accompany a push of 60-degree air up into the area during the overnight hours, so we will warm as we go through Friday night into Saturday. That will be as the warm front veers winds more southerly and southwesterly by Saturday, still up quite brisk at 15 to 22 miles per hour overnight and, again, somewhat gusty. We may see some clearing Saturday behind the warm front, in which case it's possible we could see temperatures go well up into the 70s, or at least the mid-70s, if we get a good number of dry hours that day, aided by continuing strong southwesterly winds through the day. Dew point temperatures will reach the low 60s, providing a very spring or even summer-like feel to the air. And then more concerted showers and thunderstorms may set in again overnight into Sunday, with temperatures staying up in the low 60s through the overnight and returning to 70 or so on Sunday. Overall, it does not appear that we'll build enough instability and shear together to develop severe weather, so thunderstorms or not, this should be relatively uneventful, but very wet. At the moment, down here at the station on Bedford Street, the temperature is 51 degrees. The dew point temperature is 21. Winds are out of the southeast at 7 miles per hour. Completely clear skies over the station in every direction at the moment. And the barometer's at 30.23 inches of mercury and fairly steady over the past few hours.
We go now to April 1967. For a tense election night, an ambitious plan for the rundown Atwood Avenue, and the first pop rock show at the new Dane County Memorial Coliseum. Stu Levitan has those headlines and more from 57 years ago on tonight's Madison in the 60s. All these come back. They melt into a dream.
Madison in the 60s, April 1967. On the 1st, graduate student Paul Soglin resigns from the WSA Student Senate so he can spend his time working on campus community relations through the new University Community Action Party. On the 2nd, legendary bebop trumpeter Dizzy Gillespie brings his quintet to the Union Theater for two shows. On the 3rd, the UW faculty approve a new visitation plan, allowing each residence hall living unit to decide by a two-thirds vote whether to allow visitors of the opposite sex in their rooms between noon and 10 p.m. on either Saturday or Sunday. Visitations are voided if the living unit serves beer at a social function before or during the visitation period. House officers will be responsible for enforcing the requirement that doors, quote, must be left ajar during visits. April 4th is Election Day, and Mayor Otto Fesky is in the fight of his life. Fesky, the longtime Dane County Clerk, won his first term in 1965 by 8,000 votes. But crime and taxes are both up. College students are causing trouble, the building trades are on strike, and everything feels like it's breaking down. So tonight, he's ahead by only 30 votes with just one precinct left to report. The 46-year-old Fesky almost got to run unopposed, but attorney and former broadcast personality William Dyke entered the race just hours before the January 31st deadline. The 35-year-old, who finished third in the seven-way primary 2 years ago, campaigns almost exclusively on Fesky's spending, taxes, and purported failures of leadership, and avoids culture and crime. A former aide to GOP Lieutenant Governor Jack Olson, Dyke enjoys active support of local and state Republican officials, while the Dane County Democratic Party doesn't even endorse Fesky, even though he had been elected county clerk 6 times as a Democrat. At least the Madison Federation of Labor's Committee on Political Education endorses the incumbent. Fesky cites as his primary accomplishment the recent acquisition of a site on Milwaukee Street for the long-sought East Side Hospital, making progress on the Monona Basin Auditorium and Civic Center, and forming the Alliance of Cities to lobby for better state shared revenue. And he notes that most of the tax hike has been for the schools, not city services. Fesky runs moderately well throughout the city. Dyke wins fewer wards, but by larger margins, especially his Nakoma neighborhood. It all comes down to University Heights, a precinct with 1,000 votes. About 10 o'clock at night, the last numbers come in. Fesky 511, Dyke 474. Fesky gets his second term by just 75 votes, reduced to 62 after a recount. He's in for another term, which will be even rougher than the first. No such struggles on this election day for Ruth B. Doyle, easily re-elected to her second 3-year term on the school board. Project assistant for the Dean of Student Affairs, focusing on recruitment and support of black students, and a former state legislator and county supervisor, she's the wife of federal judge James E. Doyle. Meanwhile, Fesky's planning department continues its work on the Atwood Avenue Business District, issuing a bleak report this month on its, quote, depressing, unexciting appearance. It that is unplanned, inconvenient, unattractive. A commercial district of old, deteriorating structures and skyrocketing vacancies. City consultants Midwest Planning and Research Incorporated find most of the buildings are in poor to fair condition and a, quote, declining community spirit, especially among the young people living and working in the area, evidenced by a lack of local focus on neighborhood problems. Their 72-page solution is a private urban renewal plan, starting with a 40,000-square-foot shopping center featuring a full-service supermarket and chain drugstore on the lakeside corner of Atwood Avenue and Winnebago Street. In order to provide a more pedestrian-friendly environment by diverting cars from Shakes Corners, the consultants propose a new road aligned with the railroad tracks from First Street to Division Street. The report also says the venerable Eastside Businessmen's Association has become, quote, too diffuse to be effective in promoting the area's revitalization and recommends a new nonprofit corporation be created to acquire and redevelop properties. On the 8th, the Student Peace Center presents the largest anti-military ball yet, featuring satirical skits and music by Ben Sidran and Johnny Kalb. On the 11th and 12th, a coalition led by Students for a Democratic Society, United Community Action, and the Committee to End the War in Vietnam conducts an orderly rally and picketing of CIA recruitment at the law school. About 150 students, mostly young women, sit in without obstructing, while up to 800 rally on Bascom Hill. About 50 students interview with the agency, although some, like former SDS leader Marty Tandler, who lists another SDS officer as a reference, are not actually seeking employment. On the 12th, rock and roll will make its first appearance at the new Dane County Coliseum, with Paul Revere and the Raiders as the headliners. On the 20th, school superintendent Robert Gilberts, who succeeded Philip Falk in January 1963, accepts appointment as the superintendent of the Denver Public School System. On July 5th, the school board votes 4-3 to name West High School principal Douglas Ritchie superintendent.
Ruth Doyle, who cast the only vote against Ritchie's appointment as principal in 1964, leads the opposition, saying Madison is too big to be a starter district for a first-time superintendent. And April is indeed the cruelest month, as two Madison families mourn soldiers killed in Vietnam. On the 14th, Army Private First Class James Cliffcorn, 22, Edgewood Academy class of 1962, is fatally shot while serving with the 1st Cavalry Division in the Anlo Valley. Cliffcorn was 3 months shy of graduating from Mary Knoll Seminary and entering the priesthood when he dropped out to join the Army to go to Vietnam. An Army Specialist 4th Class Leonard D. Thompson, 21, 42 Worth Court, is killed when his tank battalion is ambushed in Quang Tri Province on April 25th. A member of Plymouth Congregational Church, he worked at Sub-Zero before entering the Army shortly after his graduation from East High in 1965. He had served in Vietnam for about 6 months. And that's this week's Madison in the 60s. For your award-winning, listener-supported WORT news team, I'm Stu Levitan.
And that does it for us. Thanks for listening. Writers this evening were Russ Mackey and Greg Sanderson. Special thanks to our contributors Jose Carlos Teixeira, Stu Levitan, and Mike Moen. Katie Giorgello is our on-air engineer. Faye Parks produced the newscast, and Shelley Pittman is the news director at WORT. I'm your host, Robert McClure.
And I'm your host, Vicki Iden. Stay up to date with the WORT Local News Podcast. Subscribe on iTunes Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever else you get your podcasts. Up next is Query, followed by This Way Out. Good night.
You're listening to WORT-FM Madison.
Are you excited to get out and see some great live music while wiggling your toes in the grass? Do you yearn for delicious food and a cornucopia of local brews? Craving the whimsy of browsing local crafts or creating your own artwork? Are you ready to usher in the summer music festival season? Then get to Warner Park on Sunday, May 19th for Wartstock, presented by WORT and Union Cab of Madison. Check out this great lineup. At noon, Son del Atlantico ignites the day with hot Afro-Colombian flair. At 1:20, Strings to Rome brings lively bluegrass and folk. At 2:40, Blue Stem Jazz unleashes undisclosed Sims from Chicago. At 4 is Roscoe Foster and the Rascal Theory, ready to funk things up with their mix of rock, blues, funk, and soul. The Forward Marching Band will rouse the crowd into some good old sing-along fun before Boiled in Lead tops off the day at 5:30 with their Twin Cities-based Celtic sound. This year also marks the 20th year of No Crap on Tap. Madison homebrewers and